Good afternoon, Your Honors. May I have a warning at 5 minutes?
Sure.
Thank you. Your Honor, I believe there are a number of issues that are raised, but I think the ones that are probably most central to the argument between the parties is whether or not Crowe's applicable.
Excuse me, could you identify yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Sure.
Charles Torres on behalf of the plaintiffs.
Thank you, Mr. Torres.
Thank you. Judge, I believe the judges, I believe the arguments made by the defendants is an attempt to expand Crowe beyond what was meant by the court when it addressed this particular issue. I think the Supreme Court basically was addressing a very limited set of facts, and that limited set of facts really does not pertain to the Lee issue, which is a much broader issue. We had no final board decision in the Crowe case, and that's what was really central to the analysis for the Supreme Court, in that Mr. Crowe or Dr. Crowe was asking for the court to really expand the statute to allow a party to attack the proceedings before there was ever a final record, which raised a number of different issues in terms of the statute, that is policy issues, the terms, the issue of whether or not the statute was meant or could be allowed to be expanded because it did deal with common law rights that were now codified in the statute, and so it covered a number of different issues. In the Crowe case, we did not have Dr. Crowe challenging a summary suspension of his privileges, and as was very clearly pointed out by the Supreme Court in the Crowe case, Mr. or Dr. Crowe was really complaining about an issue that did not solely arise from the peer review process, but arose from or did complain about an issue that solely arose from the peer review process, specifically an issue that dealt with patient care. And in the Lee case, we have something totally different. We have a doctor, a set of doctors, who were threatened independently of any peer review process long before that issue ever arose, and were told if you don't go along with other specialists, then there's going to be retribution for your particular actions. And then actions were taken outside of the bylaws of NCMC by Dr. Burton and by another doctor, Dr. Frazier, who neither one were acting in their particular capacity and were certainly not following their bylaws. There was no review, which I think is in contradiction to what I think the defendants argued, that there was some sort of review process, even if it didn't follow the bylaws, that resulted in a determination that something should be done with Dr. James Lee's privileges as it related to trauma care. The record does not support that position at all. What in fact happened was we had two really rogue doctors who decided not to follow the bylaws, who then went to Dr. Melman, who had no connection to any peer review process, and then made the determination to threaten Dr. James Lee into giving up his trauma privileges or else face reporting to the Physicians National Data Bank.
But that was done on what basis?
I'm sorry?
That was done on what basis? Was it done because of a concern of competition, for instance? And if so, doesn't that drive the issue a certain way?
Well, here's how I understand the issue to connect. We have specialist doctors threatening another clinic, and it's competing doctors, if you will, and not in the traditional sense of anti-competitive conduct, but really in retaliation. And as a result thereof, we have an action that doesn't arise from a concern for patient care, but it really arises from an issue of economic differences over how one should proceed.
Well, I've got a quote from the complaint that says, defendants conspired and agreed to retaliate against plaintiffs in their clinic to destroy competition in Greeley in northern Colorado. Doesn't that put competition at the heart of what the complaint was about?
It certainly can, and I think, as I said and conceded, whether we want to call this retaliation or anti-competitive conduct, that really does not change the issue that particular anti-competitive conduct occurred 7 months before we ever get into a peer review process. And as I read the statute and the legislature was not interested in getting involved in activities that occurred outside of the statute, but were interested in the most important issue, and that is having doctors available to review colleagues' performance in the context of patient care. and we do not have this. This particular problem arose outside of the peer review process, not inside the peer review process. The defendants have to make the argument, well, at some point in time, we finally got around to allowing a peer review process to conform with the bylaws to begin, and at that point in time, if there was any complaints by Dr. Lee, Dr. James Lee, that in that particular situation, we're somehow magically now pulled into the peer review process.
Well, let me ask you this. Where do you draw the line between an improper peer review process and what you're saying right now is it's outside the peer review process? Where do you draw that line where you're saying you're not complying enough?
Okay, I think when you don't have a peer review process at all or any semblance of the parties complying with the peer review process, then I say you're talking about more than, as the defendants, I think, characterized what we were complaining about, that we had kind of a defective process. In this particular situation, you didn't have, once an individual from the hospital makes a complaint about a doctor, which is totally fine, that we have no argument with that, that they can do that, then immediately the bylaws kick in and they say this is how the process is supposed to work. And the reason that's so important is because in the instance where there is immediate danger to patient care, then the summary suspension process occurs, and that means that things have to move along very quickly, like within 30 days, in order for you to get from point A to point B. Or if there is not immediate patient concern about immediate patient care, then the other process follows. So my position is this. I think there is a very clear distinction, and it is very easy to determine based upon the bylaws. You can have imperfections in the process, which we also complain about at a later point in time from the standpoint it was a continuation of the anti-competitive conduct of a group of rogue doctors that then carried over into the peer review process, but that's a different issue. I can understand the argument there that you're saying, well, look, you know, if you're going to start complaining about the peer review process, everything else was not perfect, then that's something you wait for, get a final board decision, and come back and complain about that. That's another thing that makes us different from Crow, because we had a final board decision, and our complaint, as I laid out in my opening brief, our allegations very clearly stated, among our other concerns, our major concern was the damage that was done during the 7 months that we were fighting with NCMC to get into the peer review process.
Mr. Torres, yes. Let me ask you about that seven-month period. It seems that to me in some ways that the parties' arguments here are like ships crossing in the night, because your argument is based upon retaliation during those 7 months, and the defendant's argument is based upon saying this is a peer review process, and therefore the CPRA procedures must necessarily apply. What law applies when it appears to be the case, as here, that you have both a retaliation component of a claim and the peer review process as well?
Well, I think, let me preface the remark this way. The defendants demonstrated that there was a difference between acting outside the bylaws and acting within the bylaws, because once they started acting within the bylaws, their argument and what they did was consistent with at least following the bylaws, even if we have some additional complaints about how that occurred thereafter. In terms of the court's specific question, I think the difference is this, that in Riles, I thought the Colorado Supreme Court was very clear, and I don't think anything they said was inconsistent with Crow, and that is you can have an anti-competitive situation arise either outside of the peer review process totally, or it can have its roots outside of the process, even though it may have some lap over into the process itself. So I think you can make that distinction based upon the Riles case, and I don't think Crow did anything to take away from that particular argument. Crow specifically talked about Section 7 and 8 in terms of what was occurring within the process and what should be in front of the Court of Appeals or a reviewing court in terms of being able to determine what the record is down below. The things that happened to James Lee and Jeff Lee and their practice, all of those things occurred outside of the peer review process. And maybe a good illustration to Judge Lichtenstein's question is, Jeff Lee was totally impacted. He was never in front of the peer review board. The first threat that occurred, occurred with him telling him that he and his practice and his brother's practice would be destroyed if they didn't go along with this. Had Dr. James Lee did nothing, that particular, there would be no way that the defendants could make an argument that somehow the peer review process should apply to Dr. Jeff Lee's claims, the clinic's claims, which also overlap into Dr. James Lee's claims.
Mr. Torres, you have just under 5 minutes left.
Okay, thank you.
I did have a question about that. You were referring to Dr. Jeff Lee's claims. What were Dr. Jeff Lee's claims distinct from Dr. James Lee's claims?
I believe that civil conspiracy for sure. The interference with contract claims, I think, should certainly survive. I think the defendants would argue that the defamation claim would not be a direct claim that Dr. Jeff Lee could possibly make claim to. But nonetheless, I think you could probably make a better argument that there is a derivative claim for Dr. Jeff Lee from the defamation that was that occurred with Dr. James Lee than you could make in terms of preventing Dr. Jeff Lee from being part of the case because, as the defendants argue, they claim because of the peer review process, any claim that Dr. Jeff Lee had, it would have to derive from Dr. James Lee's claims. And I find no cases that support that, and certainly the statute does not have any discussion about whether or not you can have a derivative claim or not derivative claim. And to extend that argument, to allow that, would totally, I think, contort what we're trying to accomplish with the statute. I think the statute should be construed in a very limited fashion. I think what Ryle said, I think what Crow said, I think what was stated, I think in the Fenniger case, is a very consistent way to interpret the CAC, and that is to allow physicians to pursue claims in the district court after there is a final board decision where those particular claims, and in this particular case, antitrust claims, arise from something aside from the peer review process. And I understand the court's concerns with, well, where's that fine line drawn? And I think in this case, the facts are very clear. We have a fine line drawn, and that is we have 7 months where we can't get in there, where we have doctors that cannot explain why they were doing what they were doing or how they were able to enforce Dr. James Lee to give up his privileges under a threat of reporting to all of a sudden a miraculous change 7 months later where they're saying, okay, we're going to do the process now, Mr. Torres, and we're going to follow what you said we should be following. They can't have it both ways, and I think it would be horrible precedent if we allowed them to have it both ways because there is a difference. An extreme case providing a very good example of an antitrust claim that is not subject to the CAC is obviously Riles, where you had a pure business decision, where you had a doctor who wanted to get involved in the economic benefits of hooking up with a hospital to provide certain types of services. That was a pretty clean-cut case to say, clearly we do not have patient care involved or physician competency involved. In this case, it's a little less clear, but factually it's extremely clear what started this issue and how it ended up getting taken into the peer review process. So I would argue that the court could make a determination and could make a separation and say, look, for the period of time that Dr. Lee and his clinic was attacked for that first 7 months, that is an action by the hospital that's clearly outside the peer review process, and there's nothing to indicate prior to that period of time we had any kind of peer review process going on. And defendants, you have demonstrated for us that point by starting a peer review process 7 months later, which followed all the bylaws that you were supposed to follow. So we would ask the court to at least seriously consider that particular distinction in terms of our argument. We believe the defamation claim, which I don't think the defendants have really ever responded to in our brief, I think is totally controlled by Fenniger, and I submit that Fenniger indicates that that particular claim should not be impacted by the CAC. And as I've already indicated, I think Dr. Jeff Lee's claims, at least in reference to two or three of our claims, that those claims should not be impacted by the peer review process, or else that's going to create a horrible precedent. We're going to have a bunch more cases up here in front of you based on that issue. The attorney's fees issue and the immunity issue, The immunity issue, I would argue, we do not have a complete record. That's why the trial court asked us to supply them, supply the court with more briefing and asked to have that particular hearing in this particular case. Can the court make a ruling as a matter of law? I suppose theoretically, that probably is correct based upon the record here, but I would submit two things. One, if the court is going to make that determination, I think the record is clearly in favor of the plaintiffs in terms of making, presenting their burden. But out of all due caution, I would suggest that the trial court be allowed to finish its job before there's any determination on that point.
Mr. Torres, your time is up, but Judge Roman has a question he'd like to ask.
Yes.
Since you won't be coming back up to the podium after all.
Oh, did I go 15?
Yeah. So I thought I'd ask you my question now.
Thank you.
What's the basis of the attorney's fees award exactly in this case?
The basis of it is the court initially obviously ruled in our favor and said we met our 12B requirements. And then the court, once the Crow case came out, said, you know what, I think the Crow case controls and you needed to exhaust remedies. So therefore, the court reversed itself and said, I'm going to look at this as a 12B motion, even though the case was postured as a summary judgment motion.
So it was a 12B ruling. That's the basis for it, that you didn't meet the elements under 12B.
That's correct. When he granted the motion for reconsideration, that's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Torres. Before you begin, I'd like to ask how many of you are planning on arguing, and if there's more than one, have you agreed how you hope to divide your time? Okay, that makes it easy. Thank you. And if you need an extra minute or so, I'll be happy to give that to you since Mr. Torres got a little extra time.
Hopefully I won't. Thank you. Good afternoon. May it please the court, I'm Linda Siderius, and I am speaking on behalf of all defendants, although my co-counsel is present. Just as a point of reference, I may interchange the word Banner Health with North Colorado Medical Center. I tend to just be a little bit more familiar with NCMC from Greeley, and not to confuse that they are the same entity. I want to start with the plaintiff's counsel's own words from his oral argument before you. That is, the peer review process was initiated in retaliation related to competition. That is the holding in Crow that requires exhaustion of administrative remedies pursuant to the Colorado Peer Review Act. He also said competition started this and was taken into the peer review process. Again, the fundamental principle of the Crow v. Penrose case and the requirements of the Colorado Peer Review Act that requires exhaustion of administrative remedies.
Ms. Siderius, you would agree, I assume, that if there had been no peer review process here and just the retaliation claim in the absence of any peer review proceeding, that there would have been no administrative process to follow at all?
I would agree if there had not been the peer review process, which was evaluating Dr. James Lee's competency and qualifications relative to his privileges at NCMC, that had there been common law claims arising out of some other relationship, that it would not have been subject to the CPRA claims or HICWA claims, protections, and he could have proceeded.
Well, then let me ask you a follow-up question.
Sure.
Similar to what I asked Mr. Torres. In this case, some of the allegations in the complaint concerned this seven-month period before peer review proceedings occurred. So what do we do legally when you have some proceedings that are alleged to be retaliatory before there's a peer review proceeding and then are followed by a peer review proceeding?
I think that's an interesting question, Your Honor, because in part I think maybe this is some of the factual issues that arise in the Fenninger case, which are sort of common law claims which ostensibly may not be subject to the CIPRA or the HICWA protections. However, I think that the plaintiffs can't have this both ways. He has, by virtue of his complaint, over half of his complaint recites the deficiencies, the allegations arising out of the peer review process. He himself has linked the retaliation directly to competition. And I don't think that the court can parse out these claims because he's saying, in fact, the claims arise because the defendants initiated this peer review process in retaliation. That is the very kind of claim that the Colorado Peer Review Act contemplates in the Committee on Anti-Competitive Conduct reviewing. Nicholas versus North Colorado Medical Center, I think, is very instructive in that, which talked about factually an individual in the community who started a peer review process for the purpose of driving out a physician of business in Greeley, Colorado. I don't know the time frame that was involved in that, but typically peer review cases from start to finish seem to take anywhere from 10 to 12 years in the process. I also want to point out that if you look at the complaint, the facts are, as alleged by the plaintiff, that the first incident around the competition occurred, I believe, in January of 2003, when there was a conversation with Dr. Jeff Lee relative to the endoscopic family practice competition issue that brought us here today, that then the peer review starts in June of 2003. So it's not a long time period. The 7 months that he's talking about actually start in the June 2003 time period before the process gets it before the Credentials Committee into the more formal peer review process. The complaint is replete, as Judge Ramon notes, with claims of anti-competitive conduct, that this peer review process was driven to put the plaintiffs out of business.
Ms. Sideris, can you clarify for me when you're talking about the more formal peer review and what occurred before? What is your position? When did peer review, for the way it's covered under the statute, when did that begin?
That began in June of 2003. Okay. When Dr. Lisa Burton, who was then the trauma director, had concerns about the ability of Dr. James Lee to manage complex multi-system trauma cases. She brought her concerns to Dr. Melman, who was then in an administrative position as a liaison between the hospital administration and the physician community practicing at the hospital. They suggested that a peer review committee, the Surgical Quality Improvement Committee, Surgical QI as it was known as, look at these cases. And other physicians had brought concerns to her as well, physicians who had participated with Dr. Lee in the care of some of these patients.
Did those actions, were those authorized by the bylaws?
They were authorized by quality improvement protections as well as the Colorado Peer Review Act as well as by the bylaws. It is peer review at its best, which was a collection of physicians, surgeons, some of whom were trauma surgeons, some of whom were general surgeons, who reviewed with Dr. Lee the care of these cases. They interviewed him, they had a conversation with him, he took those cases out for outside review, the Surgical QI Committee took those for outside review as well. They worked with him to try to resolve this collegially before, in fact, it entered into what I would call a more formal part of the process, which was a referral by that committee, which is permitted by, again, the statutes, the rules and regulations of the hospital and the hospital bylaws. And to understand a little bit of how this works, there's two primary statutory constructs that I think guide peer review and quality management of hospitals. CRS 253109 is the Hospital Quality Improvement Management, and we cite that statute, I believe, in our brief, as well as the peer review statute 1236.5101 at SEC. They work hand in hand, they do not preclude each other. And they provide protections to physicians that engage in peer review. It is our position that throughout the entire process, the bylaws, the statute, and the policies of the hospital were done in this process, both informally as well as formally.
So, counsel, if I heard your answer earlier, you said it would not be possible to parse out retaliation versus the anti-competition aspects. Has there been a case that has gone that far and has made that declaration that in a case that starts off as an anti-competitive situation, but the allegation is became retaliatory during the review process, has there been a case that said that you can't parse those out?
No, but I think that if you look at the meaning of the statute, of the Colorado peer review statute, parsing out claims would result in piecemeal litigation and sort of chopping up. I think that's a really dangerous slope for the court to walk down, to say this claim is anti-competitive, so this claim gets reviewed by the Committee on Anti-Competitive Conduct, this claim does not. I think that if you step back and look at the intent of the 1236.5106 paren 8, which requires the Committee on Anti-Competitive exhaustion remedy, the basis of that exhaustion is that if the claims are that the peer review process and the total process was motivated by anti-competitive reasons, and the Committee on Anti-Competitive Conduct enjoys a broader analysis than traditional antitrust law, that the plaintiff isn't going to get it both ways. I mean, you can't just say, well, some claims don't get to be reviewed and some claims do, if the whole process was motivated by anti-competitive means, because that would result in piecemeal litigation. You have a part of it sitting over here at the CAC, you have another part proceeding in court. And I think, with all due respect to Judge Tubman, the one case before the Court of Appeals has been the Fenninger case, which had a common law claim of defamation, but did not have anti-competitive conduct claims attached to it. There was not an allegation that that defamation claim rose out of a process that was alleged to have been started with anti-competitive motives. And I think that that's the challenge here, is if you look at the complaint, half of this complaint alleges the deficiencies in the peer review process and that it was motivated to put the plaintiffs out of business. That is the very kind of claim that the legislature intended for the Committee on Anti-Competitive Conduct to evaluate. Another, I think, important reason for that is that one of the other purposes of the Committee on Anti-Competitive Conduct is to develop a record for which a reviewing court can then take a look at perhaps the immunity issues, it mitigates damages, as well as other claims that have arisen out of that peer review process. It is important to recognize that if the Committee on Anti-Competitive Conduct feels that the peer review was in fact motivated by anti-competitive means, it can set aside the decision of the hospital board of director. And in fact, that's exactly what happened in the Nicholas versus the NCMC case that went before the committee. The committee overturned the ruling of the board of directors.
Ms. Sideris, I agree that generally avoiding piecemeal litigation is a laudatory goal. Here we have actually three plaintiffs, both of the Drs. Lee and the clinic, and yet only Dr. James Lee was subject to the peer review proceeding. So how does that all fit together? I know you argued that there was a derivative claim on behalf of the other two plaintiffs.
And I think that even counsel for plaintiffs conceded that Dr. Jeff Lee's claims were largely derivative from Dr. James Lee's claim. And I think—
But if there are derivative, I mean, is there any case that says that derivative claims also must be subject to review by the Committee on Anti-Competitive Conduct?
There is not, Your Honor. It certainly would, I believe the Committee on Anti-Competitive Conduct would limit its review to the peer review process that Dr. James Lee underwent. It would not review the claims that Dr. Jeff Lee has. However, the fact that counsel chose not to have Dr. James Lee's claims or the process reviewed by the Committee on Anti-Competitive Conduct, I think, limits Dr. Jeff Lee to make these claims, because we've divested the court of subject matter jurisdiction because of the failure to exhaust administrative remedies here. And
but
I think that—
If what you say is correct, then there would be no claim for Dr. James Lee, but not necessarily for Dr. Jeff Lee in the clinic, unless we were to agree with your derivative claim theory.
If Dr. Jeff Lee felt there were other claims that went to him directly apart and separate from the claims of Dr. James Lee, but if you look at the complaint, the claims were that Jeff Lee's damages occurred because Dr. James Lee was not able to take trauma call, which was part of what happened during the peer review process, that forced him into terminating the contract with the hospital for the purposes of taking trauma call, and that's largely what his damages flow from, that because of the peer review process here limited his partner in helping him take trauma call, he was damaged. So I think that, in fact, does make it a derivative claim because his claims all flow from the result of the peer review process. A couple of points that I do want to make. I think that there are plaintiffs try to avoid review and this exhaustion remedy argument by two fronts. One is that we don't have these anti-competitive claims anymore because they're not antitrust claims and because this peer review is retaliation. I think the exchange I've had with you hopefully has given you the arguments for the defendants that, in fact, the retaliation, if you want to call that, is simply another word for anti-competitive conduct, and it is, in fact, the conduct which was contemplated to be reviewed by the Committee on Anti-Competitive Conduct. The other argument that counsel has presented in his briefs and arguments is that because there were flaws in this peer review process, that perhaps there were some errors or some procedural deficiencies, that somehow then the process does not get the protections and requirements of the Colorado Peer Review Act. And I think that it's important to recognize that I think that counsel has confused immunity issues with the exhaustion of remedies issues. And that is the premise of the motion to dismiss that was granted, was that the failure was to exhaust administrative remedies. And whether or not there's deficiencies in the claim do not affect the obligation to exhaust administrative remedies. And the deficiencies may have an issue for later analysis of the immunities which may be afforded to the defendants. But again, that's an element that would have been developed on the record had this case gone before the Committee on Anti-Competitive Conduct. And I believe I'm out of time. So.
Thank you very much, Ms.
Sagiris.
Thank you again, Mr. Torres. We appreciate both of your arguments in this very interesting case. They've been helpful to us this afternoon. The case will stand submitted and a written opinion will issue in due course.